So just a quick heads up, me and the guest were talking for a good chunk of time beforehand, hitting record. So I just told the guest, just go for it, explain yourself. So that's the sudden abruptness. Enjoy.
So Josh, yeah, I'm Stefan Contorno. I am a senior vice president and partner of Touchstone Wealth Partners. So I'm with UBS Wealth Management, and I'm located in Southwest Florida. Our team's a little bit different, a little more unique. So we're fortunate to be one of the top ranked teams in the country when it comes to wealth management. But we also have offices in three different states. So there are about 35 of us on our team. We have the office here in the Naples, Fort Myers area in Florida. We also have an office in Ohio and an office in Manhattan. We manage, I guess, around $4.2 billion in clients' assets, which puts us at one of the top in the firm at UBS. And basically, we're a team of specialists. So we have roughly 35 people on the team that really focus on financial planning, which is a lot of what we do. So we work with entrepreneurs. We work with retirees. We work with lots of different, a lot of people in the medical profession. And everything we do starts with a financial plan. And then we kind of work backwards to be able to do and help them achieve really everything that's important to them.
That's interesting. I wouldn't think of medical, but doctors do have a very good income and they would want to put it to work. And also you
they do. Yeah, sorry.
I was saying you can also advise them how to pay off their debt correctly without like living off rice and beans kind of thing.
Well, that's right. As you know, I mean, listen, physicians do well, but they do take on a lot of debt. So for us, it's working with a lot of primary doctors, a lot of surgeons, and actually a lot of dentists. So a lot of those in the dental world, and then with specialties, you know, within there as well, like orthodontists. But you're right, they make a good income, but doctors will tell you, they'll be the first to say that all those years of school cost them quite a bit of money. So it takes them a while, I think, to really get themselves going before they're really more established from an income point of view.
I think one doctor I was talking to, he's like, I got lucky and my parents were very well off, so they covered half of it. I had to cover the other half. So it only took me 5 years instead of 20 years to pay off everything.
Very lucky.
I'm like, wow. You just say it so casually. He's like, yeah, but he's like, I make, let's say, 400,000. He's like, 60% of that is all for debt.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, you're right. And it takes a long time to make that up. And you're right about that. I think a lot of doctors, you hear, you know, $1 million plus when they get out of school. And then of course you want to go in your own practice and that costs money. You have to, you know, rent a place and hire staff and get office equipment. And it's very expensive.
It really is. And it's one of those, it's more of a calling than for the money kind of thing.
There's no doubt about that. I think anybody who gets into it for the money, they're in it for the wrong reasons, and they're probably not going to get through it. I would think a large percentage. I mean, I remember, you know, when I was in high school and grammar school, I mean, the friends that I had then who ended up becoming physicians, they knew all along that's what they wanted to do. One of my really good friends in high school, I mean, always wanted to be a doctor. And of course, he is one now, and he lives in California, actually. No surprise whatsoever that that's what he ended up doing.
Yeah, there's just certain people. You just look at them and be like, yep, 20 years, that's him kind of thing.
Absolutely. No doubt about that. I think we all, you interview a lot of people. I don't know. I'd be curious. I mean, do a lot of them have the passions of their profession now when they were young, or do you not necessarily see that as much with entrepreneurs?
Actually, I want to say, if we're going to throw in an entrepreneur spin to that, a lot of them, they just stumbled into it.
It's kind of interesting. Thing. Okay.
One of my first guests, he's an accountant, been running his firm for like 30 years. But he literally was like an engineer in the army. But that's where his general was like, hey, you're good with numbers, though. Why don't you look into accounting? And he's never looked back since.
Isn't that interesting? Sometimes you need a little help along the way of somebody identifying. So I know, I'll tell you, for me, I grew up in New York, in the boroughs of New York. So growing up there, you're so close to Wall Street, and a lot of people, you know, you have a lot of people who become, you know, really noble professions like police officers and firefighters and teachers. And then you also have a huge part of the population that decide they want to work on Wall Street. And I was one of them. So I guess I was probably 11 or 12 when I knew I had a passion for wanting to be in the financial world. Now, I had no idea to what degree and what I would actually be doing once I would get there. And it's obviously not easy to break into any profession, but certainly in Wall Street, it's a very competitive area, but I was probably about 12 years old. I remember summertime, I'd be sitting on the carpet in our family room, and I'd have like this little graph paper, and I'd actually chart stocks. And back then, you know, to date myself before the internet, it was all in a newspaper. So I'd grab a newspaper and I'd pick a bunch of different stocks and I'd chart them to kind of see how they were doing. So it's funny how you end up sometimes getting into something that was a passion when you were much younger.
That's very true. Yeah. The weirdest thing for me is I'm good at retaining and not losing. And it was just one of those, like, back in high school, I didn't even realize I was being a loan shark before it was even a thing. Some people would be like, hey, I need to borrow $3. I'm like, that's fine. But every day you owe me 25 cents on that.
Wow. Okay. Okay.
So it was,
I hate to ask what you did to them if they didn't pay you back.
But I didn't know anything better. So I just bugged them until they're like, okay, fine. Here's like the extra $5.
Here it is.
But yeah, I didn't know it, but it was one of those, I would never lose money, but I could always make more kind of thing. It was just one of those, as a kid, I'm like, it's normal, right? But I'm like, now I'm realizing that's not normal at all.
So as a financial guy, I'll ask you then, do you protect your money then? Do you find like, do you not spend a lot of money? Do you find like to save it or invest it?
I try to be as frugal as possible.
Yeah. Okay, good. That's nothing wrong with that at all. Very smart. Unfortunately, as we know, most people in America spend more money than they make.
Yes.
And that's obviously a huge problem. So it's great, you know, at a young age that you're doing that. It's terrific.
Yeah, it's just one of those, I've always had it. So for you, you were mentioning Wall Street. What, other than the newspaper and charting, how else did you know you wanted to break into the game?
Yeah, well, back in the 80s, there was a pretty well-known movie called Wall Street, right? That a lot of us are familiar with. And, you know, I remember as a kid watching that movie. And of course, listen, it was all about greed and it was all about things that most of us don't necessarily agree with. Mm-hmm. About being greedy, but it was a movie that kind of portrayed, you know, a young, back then, stockbroker. Now we're more financial advisors, but a young stockbroker at the time who was trying to make his way through Wall Street and ended up seeing the good and the bad. But I remember, you know, watching that movie and Bud Fox was the character by Charlie Sheen saying like, this is just such an interesting lifestyle, right? As far as, you know, obviously you could get fame and you could do well. But it's funny because the business has evolved so much. So that was, you know, the younger version of me seeing something like that. But I'll tell you, Josh, I mean, now as the industry has evolved so much and become more wealth management, more financial planning, the days of people calling strangers on the phone, trying to have them buy and sell stocks is so far gone. Now the business is all about really just helping people achieve goals that are important to them and just really being successful. A lot of the people that I work with, to some degree, and not all, but a lot of them are wealthy already, right? So it's up to me to not only help them with good solutions, but to make sure that they don't do anything stupid with their money. That's the bottom line. It's solving problems. So you can have all the money in the world, and we see this with athletes all the time. And unfortunately, things happen and cause them to, in some cases, lose all their money.
Well, also they go and buy like expensive tigers that are just a fortune in themselves to feed.
That's exactly right. And listen, that's tempting, especially, you know, when you're a 21-year-old NBA player or, you know, or NFL player, and all of a sudden you have a lot of money and maybe it's new to you and you didn't have money before and you didn't grow up seeing it as much and you want to splurge and then you have people asking you. And we find this with, you know, any of the more celebrity type of clients that we work with. All of a sudden everybody wants a piece of what they're getting and, have to be really, really careful. So I think your attitude on money and being more frugal is good. I mean, there'll be a time where, you know, as you keep building and anybody in general, where they can start doing different things. But to some degree, that's just a mentality. I've always been that way as well. So I could absolutely relate to that.
That's awesome. Yeah. I've also noticed in general, just talking to people, that truly birds of a feather flock together. So if you're wanting to spend, well, there'll be plenty of people that'll take your money kind of thing.
Exactly right. You're right about that. And that goes back to what that whole, the five connections that are closest to you, right? I mean, you represent the five people you spend the most time with, and you're right about that. Birds do flock together. So you're right.
So you were mentioning it earlier that you were in New York, but now you're in Florida. What was the transition from New York and why did you just jump to Florida?
Oh boy. It's an interesting story. Okay. So I am, you know, again, I've always been one of those people who I'm not necessarily a person you would say is a risk taker. You know, I'm fairly conservative, but I will tell you from a career point of view and in life in general, there've been times where I have taken some risks, sometimes not realizing maybe how big they are, but I'll bring you back to about 13 years ago to about 2008, 2007. I living in New York, great place to grow up in New York. I mean, I was born in Brooklyn and grew up in Staten Island, New York, and very close-knit family. And I have always wanted to live somewhere where it's a nicer climate as far as the weather goes. And you know, certainly where you're sitting in Southern California, where I'm sitting now in Florida, both just such attractive areas. So I always wanted to be in a climate where the weather's nice all year round. And my wife and I had discussions about looking into maybe going into you moving to California or Florida. And it was tough. Actually, it was tough to sell her on this. So it took many years. And my mom at the time was a snowbird going down to Naples, Florida. And really, I would say even more of a semi-snowbird, only a couple of weeks, a year or so that she'd spend time down there. But my wife and I would go down every year to visit her for a little bit. And we fell in love with the place till one day my wife kind of looked at me and said, you know what, this is a nice place. And I said, well, hold that thought, right? Let's maybe we can make this happen. So to make a long story short, in 2008, we decided to put our home for sale. We didn't know how long it would take. As you remember, so this was February of 2008. Certainly, 2008 is a year we will never forget.
I was going to say, you're early into the crash.
A little bit. You're exactly right. So it's a little early, but we knew something bad was happening, right? Because it really started in 07, but no one knew to what degree it was going to take form. So we put the home for sale, and I'm a big believer in what's meant to be is meant to be. So I kind of told her that, you know what, listen, it's February. If the home doesn't sell by the end of the year, then it's just not meant to be. Well, okay. As you can imagine, 14 days later, our house sold. And here we are deciding, okay, we're going to be moving to Florida, to Southwest Florida. So it was an interesting thing. And the reason I say it was interesting is because I was already in this business. I've been doing this my entire adult life in a wealth management business. And I already had an established practice in New York and New Jersey, great clients, great people that I work with, a team. And basically we decided we're going to go move 1,200 miles to a new place where essentially, except for some very few exceptions, we almost didn't know a single person. And that's what we did. So we packed up, moved down here, and it's been an interesting journey ever since.
So I want to say, you were mentioning 08. So when you came to Florida, did you buy at the peak for your place or?
Yeah, I think the homes were softening just a little bit because especially over here, and I know again, parts of, I guess it was Arizona, parts of California. I mean, there were parts that were really overextended, you know, which was obviously part of the big problem in 2008. So I bought probably more of a moderate peak of where things were. So I didn't buy it at a top by any means. I probably certainly didn't buy at a low. But yeah, we bought probably somewhere in between and bought a home that was just perfect place to raise our two children down.
That's wonderful. And especially where you are in Florida, Jeff, the guy we were mentioning earlier, he lives on near Napa.
Oh, okay. Okay. So yeah, so I'm in a place called Bonita Springs, Florida, which is actually right in between Fort Myers and Naples. And I think it's pretty much one of the fastest growing places in the United States at this point. You and I have had this discussion before that we're just having so many people, whether it's from California or high tax states and the Northeast in general, a lot of people moving down here and the population is literally growing by the minute.
It is. And it's one of those, I actually was the apartment guy we were talking about earlier. He was saying he's upset with it because he's like, give it 10 years. They're going to forget why they moved here. They're going to impose all their liberal taxing and stuff on us. And he's like, but that's why we're here. Like, remember why you're here.
That's exactly right. It's a great state to be. The weather's been terrific, and we've grown our practice. I'm sure we'll get to that at some point. We've grown the practice quite a bit down here, so it's been a very good move. Again, it's a calculated risk. I mean, you know, you wake up one day. It sounds like you wake up one day and you decide you're just going to move. And while it sounds like that was the case for me, there was so much more going on in my mind to see if it was the right move to move everybody down here.
Yeah. As I was reading your little bio you sent me, it sounded like you didn't fully have a job lined up yet, kind of thing?
Actually, I did. Okay. So I was I stayed with my current firm. Just moved down here to service clients, but I did make a change. So I started my career in the late 1990s with a firm called Payne Weber. Now, Payne Weber, for your younger listeners, they're not going to know that name, but Payne Weber was just really an outstanding firm in the United States. And in 1999 to 2000, right around that time frame, UBS, my current firm, actually bought Payne Weber. So I'm what you call a boomerang. I started with a firm, I left for a period of time, and then I came right back. And while I was still at Payne Weber, it actually became UBS at that time. So I essentially left UBS, and years later ended up coming back to the firm.
Was it more you couldn't grow on your own, or just you liked UBS's process?
Yeah, you know, I mean, we get in our industry, I mean, people always try to recruit us. So it's pretty typical for us to get a 2 to 3 or 4 phone calls every week from different wealth management firms trying to lure us over to bring our clients. And it's a big move. It's risky. And, you know, it always has to be right for the client. And when I was at the previous firm, we really had to sit down and say, you know, is this a good move for our clients? And everything that UBS had and still has made it very attractive for us to service our clients where we are. And I've been with the firm now for roughly 7 years since I've returned, and it really has been great. We are the largest global wealth management firm in the world. And that, I think, gives us some kind of a competitive advantage to some degree, because we literally have people working in all different cities throughout the entire world, not just the United States. And I guess to expand on that, the advantage is, if you and I were looking to see what the economy was like in a foreign city, we could go on the internet, we could look things up, we could try to find as much information we can, but it's very different when you have people within your firm actually working there and living there and knowing the environment so well. And I believe that does help us from an advantage point of view.
Yes, if you have a home ground advantage, that's very powerful.
It really, really is. And we're in so many cities throughout the world that it really helps us a lot.
Yeah. You know, now I want to go in. You were right. I want to talk about how you grew to that. You guys grew so far and so well.
Yeah. So it's an interesting story. So so going back to my previous firm, I had a relationship with a colleague named Ken Wise. Ken has always been recognized and respected in the industry as being one of the top financial advisors in the United States. And Ken and I really hit it off from the beginning, and we always had a very common strategy of how can we build a model for our clients that could serve them the best. And one of the ways to do that is to have as many resources on our team as possible to be able to help our clients with anything and everything. So the objective here is, do you stay more as a solo practitioner, a small team, or do you build more of what we refer to in the industry now as mega teams, where we have lots of people on the team with various specialties where we can do things for clients all within our existing team. So Ken and I spoke about kind of joining our teams together at that time. He had the office in Ohio. That's how we had the presence there. And that's what we did. We actually merged the practice together. And now when you add on our New York location, we're, like I said, we're about 35 people, I guess, managing quite a bit of money, but it's a specialist type of team. So for us, I'm in more the wealth management arm of our team, Touchstone Wealth Partners. So I work directly with clients, but we also have a segment of Touchstone which focuses on institutional consulting. And that's where we do things like we manage money for insurance companies. We manage 401k plans. So many of the physicians' offices locally and throughout the United States, as well as hospitals in the United States, we manage the money for their 401k plans. And then in New York, the specialty is actually pretty unique as well. It's more on executive financial planning. So what we basically do is we will work with very large companies and help them and their executives create and monitor financial plans for them as part of a service of them being within that organization.
Okay. So I'm curious, as you were mentioning all that, a few things came to my mind. Because you were saying you had specialists. Do you have algorithmic traders on your team too?
We don't on the team. So what we do is we have portfolios within the team that we manage with the firm, with UBS. So because UBS is so large, we have access to so many different portfolios, portfolio managers, and trading teams. So we actually have people in New York in our Manhattan office that help us manage the portfolio. Now, as a firm, we have everything you just mentioned and then some. But, okay. You know, we've taken a little bit more of kind of, I refer to as the Apple model to some degree. And what I mean by that is, over the years of working with clients, you find that clients all own different types of investments. And when you're bringing in clients from different firms, at some point, they end up with so many different investments that it's very hard to keep track of. So yes. We have taken the approach of, how do we have more of the Apple model, which Apple, you know, has a certain amount of products, and that's just what they specialize in. That's what they do well, and it allows them to spend and devote all their time focused on those products. We look at it the same way from our portfolios. We keep a smaller offering to some degree. Now, we could take it much more advanced for certain people if need be, but we try to keep it a little bit more manageable. So that allows us to not only be able to handle the accounts and make sure the trading is all done properly, but also to understand fully what our clients own.
Yeah, no, that's very important, because that's when I was first learning financials, and I was listening to a podcast. It was actually a money manager team out here in California. And the first thing they said, we manage like 20 million, but they're like, you know, 20 million in the market, that's pennies. That's a drop kind of thing.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. And I'm like, oh, it's one of those. I'm like, I'm jealous, kind of like this and that. But one of them was saying, yeah, the biggest problem though, it's not even the money. He's like, you said, they're like, we have assets varying from over the counter to REITs to this. And I'm like, what's an over the counter?
Yeah, well, you have penny stocks and all different things like that. So we don't, because of the way we manage money, we don't really get involved. We certainly don't get involved in penny stocks, which are generally stocks trading under $5 a share. They're just very speculative. And so we try to keep it more, we stick with a lot of individual securities. So individual stocks for our clients, a lot of exchange traded funds or ETFs have become a very popular way to invest when it comes to investing in indexes, as well as certain types of mutual funds. But we have a model. We just try to keep things pretty simple, to be honest. Yeah. We don't get, we can't be everything to everybody. So we are very particular with the type of client we work with, because we want to make sure not only are we the right fit for them, but they need to be the right fit for us as well. And that is something that we've always tried to hold true, because when you're growing a practice, especially a practice of scale, you need to make sure that you're bringing on the right people. And the right people, the ones who essentially realize your expertise and are willing to do the things that you recommend, because it's simply to put them in a better financial situation.
It really is. And it is truly, that's the biggest thing I've picked up in general from all the entrepreneurs and executives. They're like, you know, you can fire a customer too. And I'm like, what? I never heard of this. They're like, yeah, if you don't like them, you just cut them. You give them their money back to go away.
Yeah, well, that's right. And listen, and I know you interview a lot of business owners and entrepreneurs, that's never fun. It's never something you want to do. It's not something we do often, okay? But for us, generally, what causes something like that is, we've had this happen, is if clients are not respectful to the people who work on our team. For me, you are as good as the people who work with you, right? And we make it a point of hiring what we like to think are the best in the industry. And if a client is not going to be respectful to people on our team, we need to make sure, because we're always going to treat them with respect, we need to make sure that they're doing that. Otherwise, you know, maybe they're just not the right fit.
And usually I'm assuming you're a very professional man. You're right, like maybe our firm's not good, but we know one like a state over, we can send a good word in for you for them, right?
Without a doubt. I mean, you listen, these are people that, you know, we still like, right? We still want to help, but for some reason, it's just not the right fit. We will do everything we can to try to help them. A lot of times when that happens, clients generally already know where they think they may want to go. But we're certainly happy to help them and guide them with that. We do actually, which is a little bit unique as well. And it's part of a more of our second opinion service of meeting with potential clients. But we do refer clients or potential clients to other advisors sometime if for whatever reason it's just not the right fit.
Interesting. Okay, this is just more now thinking financials. Do you get a kickback, or is it just strictly out of goodwill?
It's just strictly out of goodwill. So we, because of regulatory restraints and requirements and different things like that, getting kickbacks and things like that are not even allowed at our firm. And quite honestly, not something we wanted to do. At the end of the day, We are building a practice of serving and helping people. And if we're believers that you do a good deed and it comes back to you at some point. So if we think we're not the right fit, we will certainly refer out. And that goes back to what I was mentioning with that second opinion service. And I think that's a good way to answer your question as well, is we do a lot because of kind of a notoriety within the United States as a wealth management team. Touchstone does a second opinion service, which basically means people reach out to us and say, hey, listen, this is my portfolio. It's done okay. The market's done real well over the last decade or so, right? But for some reason, I don't feel like I'm either doing as well as I can, or I don't feel like the advisor maybe understands my goals. Would you take a look at what we have? And we do a second opinion. But here's what happens, Josh, is there's really three outcomes. The okay. first is we find some kind of a gap in their portfolio or their financial plan, and we kind of tell them how they can fix that. And then they may just go ahead and do it themselves. But a lot of times we show them what they can do to make things better. And then at that point, it's really up to them to decide if we're the right team to be able to help them implement the changes in the financial plan. And the third part, back to where you were going with this, was we find a gap. We help them with that gap and filling that gap. But for whatever reason, we're just not the right team for them. We will then, in that case, that's when we will refer out to other advisors.
Okay. Yeah, that makes the most sense. So I'm just curious, do you charge like a fee, like $100 to review it, or is it just free?
Great question. So we've spoken over the years about whether or not you charge a consultation fee to provide a second opinion. My partner and I decided that we really thought it wasn't the best thing to do. And the reason is, we could charge people a fee to do that, but we look at it as a way to really demonstrate to people what we're capable of as a team. And we don't feel charging a fee to do that is necessary. So when we do a second opinion and we give them those options, that is a way that people get to see what makes us different and unique.
Yes. No, especially in the the very stereotypical way everyone assumes Wall Street, they're going to charge you for every movement you do. So it's like, if you show like we're involved but we don't act like them, immediately that's trust right there. What do we do kind of thing.
Well that's exactly right. That's how we look at it, and I appreciate you saying that. You're exactly right about that. So no, it's a complimentary thing, and we just look at the second opinion as a way that we can just demonstrate to people what we do. And listen, at the end, if they don't feel with the right fit, that's okay, but at least they have more knowledge, because to us, education and knowledge are just extremely important. And it's a huge mission of our team in general.
Yes. So I'm now interested for you, we're talking all of this, but in the markets, but what is your take on the market with all this money printing?
Okay. Well, that's certainly an interesting time. So I certainly remember the market crash of 87. I was young at the time, but I remember that. And I got into business during the tech bubble, mm-hmm. 1999 and 2000, and that was not fun. And you know, we had periods of time during 2002 and 2008, as we mentioned earlier. But yeah, the pandemic, which leads to where we are now, has been an environment we've never seen before. No one has seen this happen, at least in our lifetimes, to know how this is going to work. So yeah. To answer your question, we are in a very unique period. The markets, as we know, last year actually surprised most people and did extremely well. We had a very good year in the majority of the financial markets, which people didn't expect would happen. And I could certainly expand on that at some point today. But okay. But that late March, early April, the markets were dropping thousands of points every single day. And for a lot of people, it made them very fearful. When we look at where we are today, there have been lots of actions taken. The Federal Reserve has really gotten involved. I mean, they lowered rates to basically 0% at this point. They're keeping it that way for the foreseeable future. There's a lot of debate about how long that will last, but for the foreseeable future, they're keeping rates low. The Fed has been buying back bonds also to help keep rates low. And then you have the Congress and the government actually, like you said, printing money, giving stimulus checks and doing various things to try to keep the economy afloat. So where that leads us to now is an environment that, again, we've never seen before. And we have gone from a world economy that was completely turned off, completely shut down.
Pretty much a year, huh?
Yeah, pretty much a year. And it depends where you are. I mean, certain states were open and a little down here in Florida, obviously, it was a little bit different as far as every state treated it differently with their businesses and their residents. But everything was shut off to now not only have businesses been opening, that's picking up even more so now. So the markets in general are always looking ahead. And I think a lot of people don't always realize that the markets don't look at exactly where we are today. They're always looking 6 months or 12 months ahead of where we are. And that's why the markets have been doing so well, because they've basically been saying, we're going to have the markets and the world open up at some point, and the demand is actually going to be absolutely enormous. We could potentially see demand for everyday goods like we've never seen in the history of this country.
Yes, yes, that is my biggest fear. I currently work grocery store as a janitor for night shift, and it's one of those, everyone at work is like, oh, it's not, inflation's not that bad. I'm like, just so you know, that burrito you bought four weeks ago, it was 30 cents less.
Well, you know your prices. You should be on the prices, right? No, but I agree with you. So, Neil, when you look at that, I mean, there are lots of areas where we're seeing inflation starting to pick up. Food is obviously one of them, and that's what most people talk about. Gasoline prices have gone up. Certainly what happened in with the pipeline didn't help. That may be a little more temporary. But also the reason gasoline prices have gone up is the demand has gone up. We had almost a year where, for most of us, we didn't put a whole lot of mileage on our cars.
No.
Now we're having a point where people are starting to drive again, especially during holiday weekends like this. So the demand for gasoline is certainly going up. But then you look at other areas, which is interesting. So certainly travel. When you look at the price of an airline ticket right now, it's extremely expensive. It really is. And then you look at hotels, and I don't know if you've gone online looking up hotels, but there's in a lot of regards, there's no vacancies, right? You can't even get in to a hotel. And if you can, the prices are extremely expensive. But what I find the most interesting is the one area that really is seeing inflation is the used car industry.
And yes. I noticed during, that too.
During the pandemic, you know, when these car rental companies were not having any demand whatsoever, a lot of them actually had to sell their cars. They just couldn't afford to keep them. Now, because the demand is so high, they're out there trying to buy used cars. And that demand is incredible. And you put on top of that the fact that new car sales right now are struggling a little bit because of the chip shortage for new cars. So in some regards, you're actually seeing used cars selling for more than new cars, which is something, again, we've never seen before.
Yeah, this whole dynamic is just out of hand. I was talking to a guy in England, well, the UK area, and he was telling me, he's like, hey, because we were just comparing notes. He's like, what was your stimulus? He's like, we're about like 3-4 trillion. I'm like, oh, I think we went like 7. And it sounds like we're going to try to do another one. So that's another 3 or 4 on that. He's like, 10 to 11 trillion. And he's like, we just did 3. I'm like, well, you and every other country pumped out a couple $1 trillion kind of thing.
Yeah, it is. There's a lot of spending going on, without a doubt. It looks like that will continue. Certainly looks like taxes are going to go up. Now, we'll have to see to what degree they go up. We'll see what kind of compromise is made. But it certainly looks like taxes are going to go up. And I guess part of that will be used to pay for all of the borrowing that we're doing.
From what I last gathered from the headlines and different news is, I don't trust it. I just more keep tabs. It's more for the infrastructure bill he's proposing.
Yeah, I mean, the infrastructure bill, I mean, right now, I mean, obviously the numbers keep changing every day as far as, you know, between the Democrats and Republicans of what they're trying to come up with and finalize. But there's, when you look at that and you look at just the spending in general, there is a lot of it. I mean, even the stimulus checks, there have been quite a bit. And let's face it, I mean, like I said, it's been, the pandemic has affected different states in different ways, but unfortunately, a lot of people have gotten hurt during this pandemic. And, you know, not only from a health point of view due to COVID, but also financially. I mean, look at all of the hospitality industry in general. I mean, all the restaurants and some states, I mean, really, we've seen so many restaurants go out of business. So it's been a very unfortunate thing.
It really has. I actually, my martial arts studio, he introduced me to this one up and coming like restaurant guy. He bought December of 19.
December. Okay. December 19. Yeah.
And it was one of those, it was a year, he was doing great. His business was growing. January of 2020, he's like, I would try to support him. Like, I have to drive like 15 miles one way for my instructor. So I'm like, screw it, I'll go get a burrito kind of thing, help him out. And essentially he just told me, he's like, if I keep this up, he's like, I can't kind of thing. He's like, and he closed. Sadly, it was like December when they were just easing off in California.
Oh, see, that's tough. Well, because listen, it's tough for some business owners to hang on a whole lot longer. I mean, again, the government tried to help in various ways through stimulus, but that's unfortunate. So a lot of small business owners definitely suffered with that. You know, like as you remember, at the height of the pandemic during that really, like, I guess, last April, May type of time frame, you know, the restaurants, I think it seemed like everybody I know, including myself, was doing everything we could to support the restaurants. And while we may not have been able to dine inside or even at the restaurant at all, the takeout was hopefully enough to help them at least not only pay for their staff and pay for their real estate, but also really just help them stay afloat.
Yeah. And I think the thing he told me that actually was good intentions, but he didn't model it in. He said, restaurants, we run on a razor thin margin. He's like, 10% is very nice if we can get that in a month. I'm like, so what do you work on? He's like, 5% or less.
Wow. Wow. Listen, restaurant industry is a tough industry. I always thought many years ago that it would be great to own a restaurant. That was always something that sounded exciting to me. I never did it. And to be honest with you, I'm glad I didn't. I mean, to open a restaurant, you really have to know what you're doing. You have to be completely devoted. And I think the odds are still against you to some degree.
In general, yeah, because there's so many uncontrolled variables. There could be a terrible Yelp review and you can't delete Yelps unless you like politely ask them and don't bribe them, because then Yelp will get mad at you.
Yeah, you want to be careful with that. But you're right, these days with Yelp reviews and other type of reviews, that could certainly hurt you. So it's a tough industry.
It is. And I think he was telling me he tried to do it just so he can keep his customers, but he said like Grubhub, Uber Eats, and he's like, they take 30% of whatever the price is.
And he's, is that, like, what they end up taking? It's 30%, huh? Okay.
And that's where he's like, you just heard, I barely work off 10% is a good day. I'm like, shit, wow. They were robbing all your money kind of thing.
Yeah. Tough business. Very tough business. But yeah, the pandemic certainly hurt a lot of restaurants. And again, lots of, you know, bars and hotels and the airline industry. So it's been tough.
So for your outlook, being a financial guy, and you've been in this at least 17 years, you said?
I'm going to date myself now. It's been about 21, 22 years.
Okay. Yeah. I was close, but not accurate. But so what do you think with the dynamics, like you were mentioning in restaurants and the flying, do you think people are actually going to go back to normal?
That's a big question. I think at the beginning of the pandemic, we all used those quotes of normal, right? The new normal and what that would look like. And, you know, how are you going to operate going forward? Will we be doing everything virtually? Will we actually go back to an office one day? What would that look like? At this point, you know, it's certainly not my expertise, but I'll tell you from what it looks like right now, it looks like things are eventually going to go back to some degree of normalcy. Now, I say some degree because there have been some changes that will probably be permanent. You know, a lot of us have become more accustomed and used to using things like Zoom as ways to virtually communicate with people. Now, in my industry, in my business, I mean, nothing substitutes face-to-face meetings. So our clients love that. That's what we do. But there, you know, if you look at certain businesses, if I were in a major city and you were a client, you had to drive an hour to come see me and find parking and then go in an elevator and then go home. And the whole, it may be easier for you now to work with us virtually. Right. Yeah. But for those of us who are in non-cities, it's our clients, is still easy for them to get to us. Commercial space is something we hear a lot about, what that's going to look like. And I don't think we quite know what that's going to look like yet, because I think a lot of the large corporations are still trying to determine what their outlook is going to be and their need for space. But it seems certainly that they're going to need less space going forward, a lot of big businesses. And time will tell, but really back to what you're saying is, I think I hope we're going to go back to as close to normal as possible, but with certain changes that I think are probably not terrible.
Right. That's the biggest thing I tell people in general, because they're like, oh, I can't wait to go back to normal. I'm like, well, let's put it this way. You survived the 2008 crash and still had a job. And they're like, yeah. I'm like, did we actually ever go back to normal after 2008? Huh. And they're like, no. I'm like, so there are some lingering damage. We still don't know, kind of thing. And you're saying all that's just going to disappear. I'm like, I don't believe that's probable.
Well, you're right. And, you know, listen, back to entrepreneurship. I mean, there, like we said, there are a lot of businesses who were severely hurt during the pandemic, and some of them survived and are surviving. Some of them are not. But then there are other businesses that started during the pandemic that have probably done very well, right? So there's always opportunities for businesses in general. Right. And I think it's one of those things you mentioned 2008, you know, we learn from the past. The problem with that, at least from what I've seen in my career, is that what we've learned, what happens going forward doesn't always look like what we saw in the past. I mean, 2008 was extremely different than the pandemic, both terrible times, but completely, completely different as well.
Yes. But I just use that extreme for them because it's something they can grab, kind of thing.
Oh, without a doubt. That extreme, whether it was in the economy in general, whether it was what we all faced, you know, as citizens of the United States and what that looked like. And even with the markets, I mean, one of the things we do when we do financial planning for clients, we always perform a stress test, what we call bad timing, where we basically go back to that period, that 2007, 2008, 2009 period, and we kind of shock their portfolio to see what would the implications be if we had that period all over again with markets going down 40, close to 50% at that point. How would that affect the outcome of their financial plan? So we do learn a lot from those periods of time. I couldn't agree with you more.
Yeah. Especially like for me in the March, I don't remember the exact day. What was the word? The market pretty much dipped like 10% in one day.
Yeah. You're referring to during 2008 or last year?
Last year.
Well, the reason I say that is markets tend to do that in March. So last really? Year, well, if you go back to the tech bubble, right? Okay. So 2000, March of 2000, right around there was when the bubble burst in the technology industry with stocks. So you have that. 2008, that was a really rough period of time. And then, like you said, last year. So I remember, and I think I have the scars to show at this point, but last year in March, end of March or so, middle of March, the markets were going down literally 1,000, 2,000 points every single day. Mm-hmm. And so for clients, I mean, watching and putting on the news and seeing every day the Dow Jones or the NASDAQ or whatever index it is going down 1,000 points in just a free fall, right? Mm-hmm. It makes people really, really concerned. Now, because we're a planning team, we did not receive as many phone calls as you'd think. And we're pretty proactive. So we reach out to everybody ahead of time. I mean, my goal is as a partner on this team is to make sure that clients, when we reach out to them, I always want them to say, that's funny, I was just about to reach out to you. That is the nirvana for me, if people could say that. But we did have a few clients who did panic to some degree and say that they were very concerned and they wanted to get out of the markets completely. And the way we look at that, and here's the thing, and, you know, looking back, you could see how detrimental that would have been. But in the moment, it's very, very difficult. And to some degree, my job is almost like a psychiatrist to some degree, right? Because I need to have people kind of and reiterate what people should focus on from a longer term point of view. And from a longer term point of view, markets, at least up until this point, always seem to come back. Now, some periods it takes longer than others. But at the end of March, when the markets were doing what they were doing, there was a period of time where we were telling clients, not only should you refrain from getting out of the markets, you actually should be investing more money. So for clients who were sitting on cash at the time and had a longer time horizon, that was a great opportunity to put money to work. But for other clients who were fully invested, but maybe more of a conservative type of investor, if they were comfortable with it, and that takes a really long conversation to assess that, but if they were comfortable, maybe just increasing the amount of equity or stock exposure that they have in their portfolio a little bit to be able to take advantage of those opportunities. And that, again, that is kind of the value that I think we bring in our industry, is having people do things that sometimes they're not comfortable doing, but ultimately ends up being a really good thing for them.
It's like the old John D. Rockefeller statement, buy when there's blood in the street.
That's exactly right. Or Warren Buffett. Warren Buffett's is when people get greedy, he gets fearful. When people get fearful, he gets greedy. And mm-hmm. exactly the same thing. And you're right. But again, doing this a long time, I understand how people think. And when it's your hard-earned money, you've worked your entire life to save this money, and you wake up one day and it's down 20, 30% or so in a short period of time, it's easy to want to panic.
Yes. Yeah. That was my biggest one when I was learning the market in general. I was buying options, but I didn't realize until later I was doing the Wall Street Bets thing where I was buying like long QQQ kind of thing. I'm like, it can only go up. And then I lose like $1,200. And that was actually more than 20% of my portfolio. And I just sat there and I'm looking at him like, how am I going to make this back? Kind of thing. But I got that out of my system real quick. I'm like, okay, we're not buying that. We're going into more like the what institutions go into now.
You know, it's a good lesson for you to learn that, because if the opposite happened, then maybe you would have gotten yourself in a lot of trouble. So you're exactly right about that. That probably worked out really well. I remember when I was a kid, you know, I would kind of, you know, like everybody watch sports and all that. And I would try to at least, you know, think I wanted to bet on sports, but I was too young to do so. But but I used to always say how great it would be to pick a team, because I know so much about, you know, say basketball or baseball, whatever it may be. And then when you're actually doing something like that, you realize how difficult it actually really is. And again, investing is the same way. You let your emotions, you could have your favorite team in sports and just believe in them so much that they're not going to lose, and not be rational, I guess, with your decisions.
Yeah. So one thing I do want to get your take on, and it's again with the new dynamics of the pandemic and all the stimulus, it's one of those no clear playbook with the Wall Street Bets and them pumping and dumping everything.
Yeah. Well, that's also an interesting one. So yeah, there's been a lot of that, obviously. And, you know, we hear about these certain stocks that they've been going after and trying to like you said, pump up. And unfortunately, so with things like that, ultimately someone could get hurt. And I think for most people, they need to just be really careful. I know that's kind of the sign of the times these days. I mean, back in the 80s or so, there were Wall Street companies that were doing things like that, where they were calling up people to buy certain stocks, and they would want the stock to rise, and then they would be getting out of it themselves. It's just think you need to be really careful with that. I mean, regulation in this industry is very, very high, and I think that's something the regulatory bodies need to continue to look at to make sure that they protect that.
Yeah, last I heard, and it could have changed already, this was actually a couple of months ago, is the SEC essentially said it's a public forum, everyone has access to it. Technically, there's no cloak and dagger, so it's like technically it's okay. It might be different now, I don't know.
You know, I'm not sure. I haven't kept up with enough. Obviously, they make the rules, and we all abide by them. So if they feel that way, then certainly that's their take. I'm not sure where it is now, but yeah, I mean, the internet in general, I mean, it's changed the world, right? I mean,
it really has.
It really has, and we're seeing that now with investing in the examples that you just provided.
Yeah, and like I think last I checked, because I was just checking in the VIX to make sure it was still going down, which is technically good, but you also got to remember it's going to go back up, kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I just saw the market news, and it's like AMC, they're pumping the shorts out. And I looked at the VIX and I'm like, oh, that makes the most sense, actually.
I did see that. Yes. I read that the other day, actually. Yeah. It's changed. I mean, listen, you have a new generation investing in the markets, and they're doing it a different way. So it's interesting to see. I'm at the point now where there's so much news out there and so much to keep track of in our industry that, quite honestly, I kind of narrow it down and focus on certain things. So while I follow those type of stories, I certainly spend my time reading a lot more literature on the markets in general, more about the bigger companies. But yeah, those are certainly interesting, newsworthy stories.
And I'm assuming, being a very big predominant planning one, you kind of foresee the crash, or positioned your portfolio in just a way so yes, there would be losses no matter what, but it was minimal, kind of thing.
Yeah, I don't think any of us truly foresee a crash, right? I mean, it's very difficult to do that, but what we do is we position clients so that when things do go wrong, because they will, right? That always happens, unfortunately. I mean, one thing that we know is always going to be constant is volatility. I mean, there's always going to be volatility in the markets, and we need to prepare for that. Now, when you have volatility, sometimes you can take advantage of that, as I mentioned earlier. And when markets drop, you can actually get into the markets and profit from that. But from what I have found, is the best way to protect yourself for the unknown in markets is through diversification. I mean, clearly, I will tell you, Josh, that most of the people come in for second opinions that we meet with are not truly diversified. They think they are. They have a portfolio and maybe they have X amount of stocks or X amount of mutual funds. And they feel they are diversified, but they're not. A lot of them are more geared towards technology type of companies or just the companies that in general have done really well over the last 6 months or so. And while that's great, you can do really well, you need to be diversified. The best way for anyone to know they're truly diversified is when you look at your portfolio and you have certain investments that you just don't like. And you don't like them, not because they're bad, but because they're not participating as well as some of the others. That's how you know you're diversified. So that incorporates owning large companies, mid-sized companies, small companies, international, selective bonds. You have to be extremely careful with bonds and fixed income these days, but things that will protect you when the markets and the economy just doesn't go the way that you would foresee.
So then what are some tips and tricks for your, with your 25 years in the business, for a young guy like me to properly diversify? We were mentioning ETFs earlier, but what are some other things you would recommend too?
Yeah, tips and tricks. So first thing is always going to come down to a financial plan. So I don't care what age you are. We all have different goals, right? You could be 20 years old and you want to retire at a certain age and that is your dream, or you want to start a business, or you could be 70 years old and want to leave a legacy to your family. Everybody has different goals. The one thing I've learned is that we all view money differently. And everybody spends their money differently as well. For some people, they want to buy cars or they want to buy homes. For some people, they take a lot of satisfaction of saving money and keeping it in the bank. Or for some people, they're philanthropic. They want to actually help really great causes. So financial planning to me is where it all should begin for everybody. Because what you do when you have a financial plan is you take a look at, we take a look at everything that you own, all your assets. We take a look at anything that you owe, all of your liabilities. And then on paper, we actually come up with a roadmap of what it is you want to do. What age do you want to retire? How much money do you want to live on when you retire? So if you want to retire at 60, how much do you think you're going to need, right? And if you don't know the answer, we'll actually tell you, because that's part of the planning. We could actually tell people how much they'll need, but maybe you want to go on a vacation every year, or maybe you want to go on five vacations every year, or whatever it may be. All of those things are put on paper. And then once that happens, the plan dictates how you invest your money. So you come up with an asset allocation or the percentage of your money in stocks, bonds, and cash. And it's almost like a sweet spot or precise allocation of how you should be investing your funds so that you could do everything that you just put on paper. And the key here is with the least amount of risk possible. That is ultimately, to me, the most important thing, because we meet lots of different clients and lots of different people who want to do well, right, in the markets. And some want to beat the markets. And then that's a whole other thing. But at the end of the day, all that's really should be important to us is being able to do everything that allows us to live the type of life that we envision for ourselves. And that's what planning does.
It really is. And in the planning, like you were saying with earlier moving to Florida, you had everything planned out. It was just the momentary risk of moving between states kind of thing.
That's exactly right. That's that calculated risk that I mentioned. I mean, one of the things that I've always done is, and every entrepreneur goes through this, is a lot goes on in your head, right? Mm-hmm. And a lot of that happens in the middle of the night and all different times of day. And for me, very quickly, I kind of put together a plan. And when I do that, and I will tell you, everybody, it happens at different times. For me, it happens a lot of time in the middle of the night, but that's where I kind of figure out, you know, what are the pros? What are the cons? What do I have to lose? And that's how you make a decision. And in that case of moving 1,200 miles, it was the right decision in my mind to do that. But there are sometimes I think of doing certain things that I realize it's just not the right decision or not at the right time. Entrepreneurship, I think, has become so glorified these days, you know, with social media. And we all see the same pictures of people flashing cars and money and doing different things. But being an entrepreneur is really hard. It's not for everybody.
No, God, no. And that's the biggest one I've picked up on in general is, I think it was his name was Steve. And he was telling me, he's like, it's one of those, you need to be uncomfortable. You need to be comfortable with people throwing shit in your face every day and smile and say, how else can I help you kind of thing.
You're exactly right. And I'll add to that, you need to be comfortable being uncomfortable, right?
Yes.
And that's a whole other segment. But sometimes, you know, when you're running a business, you need to do things that don't feel like second nature to you. Maybe that's speaking in front of an audience or doing certain things that normally you just don't feel right about, but you realize if you want to be successful and achieve certain things, you just have to do it anyway. And yeah. And that's the thing. But like I said, being an entrepreneur is not for everybody. There is, like I said, there's a lot that goes on in your mind. And I look at it where, first of all, I'm very fortunate. I love what I do. And to me, that is extremely, extremely important. You have to love what you do, but you have to be willing to work harder than anybody else. I mean, we always use the term about being hungry, right? You have to be hungry, but I think to some degree, you need to be starving, right?
Pretty much,
you need to want it so badly. But here's the other thing that I've learned that's important to me is, to me, being an entrepreneur is kind of like being an athlete to some degree. And I say that because, like, for me, my uniform may look different than an athlete. I put on a suit and tie, right? My playing field may not be an actual field. It may be an office setting. But at the end of the day, it's the same thing. We're all training to the best of our ability to be as good as we can. And that involves things like reading and keeping up with your industry. That includes even simple things that most people don't talk about, even as far as just taking good care of yourself, right? Physically yeah. and mentally, to do everything that you can to make sure that you're always at your peak performance.
That is the biggest one in general. As I've actually talked to coaches and athletes, and one of them, they're like, "Oh, I'm not an entrepreneur." I'm like, "Actually, if anything, you are probably the most entrepreneur person I've talked to yet." And they're like, "What do you mean?" I'm like, "You are hungry. You made your PR of 150, not good enough. Well, now we have to hit 160 kind of thing." So yeah, that is truly the notching of an entrepreneur.
It really, really is. I think I have found that the people I know who are successful are never satisfied with how they're doing, right? Because you don't want to rest on your laurels. You have some success or a taste of success. It's very easy to sit back and start enjoying it. And while you still want to do that to some degree, you still need to always stay hungry. I like to look at it where at any point I feel like someone could take my success away, right? Whatever success yes. I have, they could take it away from me. And I think you need to live and work every single day like that can happen. And I think that's what drives a lot of people. I mean, look at some of these really, really successful entrepreneurs or the CEOs of these tech companies. They have more money than they will ever need, yet they all have these rituals of things that they do in the morning, getting up early, doing certain things, reading, keeping up with their industry, working the hours, maybe not as many as they did when they were a startup, but they're still so focused on the end result. And at that point, it becomes a bit of a game to them and something that they really just are passionate about and they enjoy doing.
Yeah, I think it is. It's truly like the athletic mind. It's a game. The money's nice, but it's more like points on a paper kind of thing. It's like,
yeah.
It's like you said, they know they can't spend it all unless they're going to do one terrible bet on the like Wall Street kind of thing.
Yeah. And I don't think they would do that. I don't think they would want to take
that.
That's
how they made their money.
That's it. Well, you're exactly right. You're exactly right. But yes, you're right about that. It is that mindset. I have always thought of that. I mean, you know, as someone who loves sports, you know, I appreciate how hard these athletes work. I mean, you look at a Michael Jordan and people say, you know, on the off season, how hard he worked, or Kobe Bryant, how hard they worked when they weren't playing. I mean, and even I recently read something about Kobe Bryant and you know, it was all about his mindset and about, I mean, he was never satisfied with how he was doing. He was always striving to do better, whether that was on the field or off the field. I mean, these guys are wired a certain way and not everybody is wired that way.
No. And it's one of those, you can learn it, but unless you're truly wired that way, it's not going to work. You can only force yourself to do something for so long.
That you're exactly right. It's interesting too, to see, and you know, I don't know the answer to this, but you'd love to see all these entrepreneurs, at what stage did they realize they were wired that way? Because for some people, when you're younger, maybe you're not wired that way when you're younger, but maybe at a certain point in time, something shifts. And then all of a sudden you are more focused that way. I'll tell you, that happened to me. I mean, getting into this industry is where I realized kind of where my strengths are. And for some of us, listen, growing up, I mean, in high school and all that, we don't know what our strengths are. For some of us, maybe we don't feel like we have any, right? Anybody listening, we feel they don't have any. You know what? You realize that there'll be a day when you will figure out what you're really good at. You just may not know at that point. And again, I can say that for myself, but then there was a period of time where I realized, for me in general, was working. I just wanted to work. while I was in college, I worked, and all I wanted to do was get out and get a job and make money and start working. And that developed into being in this wealth management business. And now it's a passion of helping people, about educating people, and about talking about the markets and discussing financial planning. And that's what kind of gets me going. So I guess maybe it takes people some time to figure out what that passion is.
I'm going to have to agree with you for an event, because that's when I realized for me, I like put two and two together. But the biggest one I've noticed in general, and a lot of people have mentioned it, is it's one of those, if your friends are giving you a compliment about something that you specifically do well, that is something to actually take note of, kind of thing. And I never realized it. Like in high school, I had a nice mowing gig. I was making about $1,200 a month, side projects.
That's great.
Yeah. It was one of those. I was smart. I went all the rich people. I'm like, I noticed your lawns are getting long. For $100 a month, I'll mow your lawn, kind of thing.
I love that. Good for you. That's, first of all, that's great money. You know, you learn from that too. As you get older, you look back and you say, you know what? Maybe I could have hired other people. Maybe you did this, I don't know, to do some of the other lawns, right? That's the entrepreneurial mindset, right?
That's actually the part where I realized now, being older with hindsight, it's a blessing and a curse. But it was like all my friends, the few I did have, and they're like, you literally are working yourself ragged. Well, I'm like, but I like it, kind of thing. Like I'm going places other people can't even get into, kind of thing. And then that's
great.
Yeah. That's when I realized now I'm like, oh, I've literally, my talent at that time was I'll work until I know the job is done, kind of thing.
Yeah. I love that. You can't teach work to some people, right? I mean, you have to want to work hard. Not everybody does. Not everybody wants to. And listen, we all have different, we're only here for a certain period of time on earth, right?
Right.
We all have different perspectives of what's important to us. For some people who don't work hard, you may look at that in a negative connotation. And then for some people, entrepreneurs in general are so devoted to their work, maybe they do too much of it. And then for others, they look at that. And so the point is everybody's different. But I'll tell you, and another thing that I've learned is, as you're becoming an entrepreneur and as you're growing your business, there are also sacrifices you need to make. Mm-hmm. And there's so many different types of sacrifices, but I think anybody looking to get into business for themselves and to achieve some degree of success need to realize that there are things that you're going to have to give up in life.
Yes. The biggest one, I was listening to actually a podcast. I think it was one of my guests. He has a lot of good mindset people come on. And I think it was one of them where he said he grew his business in 1 year, and he said, this is not like abstract, this can be done, but you have to give up a lot. He went from no money at all in his pocket to making $2 million a year.
Wow. In 1 year.
1 year.
Good for him. Yeah.
But that's where he said he literally gave up a year. He now has $2 million. He wants to travel for a year, kind of thing. So he's going to close up shop or put it on autopilot, kind of thing, and just disappear for a year. And then he's going to come back and make four in 1 year.
Wow. Well, that's an interesting story. Yeah. I mean, for most people, they don't do that well in a year. So
right. And I just sat there, Mike.
Yeah.
It was just one of those. He said, utilize the things that you think is too much work. He said, like, if you, let's say you can get into Pepsi. I don't think it was any Fortune 500. You do free work for them. Yes, you did free work. But he's like, you now have a case study. And now you can go present it to their competitor. Like, well, I did this and they got 30% return and it was nothing. So for 10,000, I could probably get you 40, kind of thing.
Makes sense. I think that's terrific.
And
yeah, that's, sorry, you go. I was just going to say that goes back to what we said. I mean, you have to make a sacrifice. And that's, again, why entrepreneurship's not for everybody, because there are things that you have to do that other people are literally not willing to do or simply cannot do.
I think it's more willing.
I would agree.
I'll say, unless you're truly physically disabled, but I know a lot of online entrepreneurs who are physically disabled, but they have a mic and Dragon speak naturally, and they're making a shit ton of money on blogs.
Oh, sure. But that goes back to your strengths. I mean, look at how many successful people are dyslexic. I mean, I think that's a huge one.
Dyslexic.
If you look,
I think it's ADHD too.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, so again, as someone who reads, and I spend a lot of my time reading about other business owners and successful people, because you can learn a lot from them. You realize how many have like you said, different type ADHD or dyslexia, whatever it may be. And they've overcome that. And they somehow persevered and found their strength. And now they're all at the top of their game. And I love stories like that. So you're right. You have to be willing to do certain things. And again, it comes back to hard work. You have to work harder than everybody else. Now, there is a shift. There's a point when you're doing something for a while and you're working really hard. Then I think it comes down to working smarter than everybody else, right? Maybe you don't have to put in the same hours because you kind of know what you're doing a little bit better. You've figured out what works and doesn't work. That's where I think you want to work smarter. But hard work is still what's going to get you there.
This is actually this one lady. I helped her last year during the lockdowns. For some reason, she got a lot of orders kind of thing. And it was just like $100 a day. You just helped me out. But that was the one thing when we met again afterwards. She's like, just so you know, like the reason I could afford to pay you $100, it was technically cheaper to pay you to do the work for me. She's like, when you get to that point in entrepreneurship or running a business where it's technically cheaper to pay someone else to do it for you, you're like, then you truly have now hit a truly scalable business. And it's something to look into more kind of thing.
That makes complete sense. I mean, I think any successful person, there's always one issue that happens as you become more and more successful, and it comes down to time, right? Yes. We all get the same amount of time every single day. So yeah, when you hit that certain level, it makes more sense to have other people help you do certain things, because otherwise you just simply don't have enough time to do it. But at the beginning, when you're starting any business, listen, you have to do everything.
Yeah. You got to learn all of it. You got to be ahead of everyone. You got to be, like you said, it's pretty much starving.
And you do.
Like my instructor, how I met actually a couple of these people and got the different gigs. He does martial arts, which he's like, it's the hardest thing to sell, by the way. He's like, it's like religion. You just say, trust me and pay me $200 a month kind of thing. He's like, so if you can sell martial arts, you can literally sell anything. But that's the biggest thing. He's now hit that point that we're talking about where it's actually smarter for him to kick back and more just monitor or work with his devout few kind of thing.
Yeah.
Because he has single-handedly went from the peak of the lockdown to like 70 students to almost 190. Yeah. It's one of those, but he's running 60% of those students. And we've all told him, like, dude, like you, even at your prime when you were like 200, like you couldn't do it. You had like 20 instructors here.
That's a great example of you going from working in the business to on the business, right?
Right.
I mean, as he's grown, his role has changed, and it's a great story, and that sounds like a very good business.
It is, and it's one of those. He jokes about it, and it's fun, but it's one of those kid issues. Like, I get paid to be in pajamas and punch people all day.
Well, that sounds like fun, doesn't it?
Right. I'm like, well, how come?
Oh, that is great.
He's like, yeah, I'm not like rich like the other people. I'm like, no, you're happy though for what you do kind of thing. That's priceless.
That really, you know, that really is. And so he is rich, right?
In his own way, yes.
Because he loves what he does. He's happy doing it. And again, everybody has a different perspective of what rich or success looks like to them. It's different for every one of us. And, you know, in that case, yeah, he's done well.
He has. I'm just curious, how long do I have you? I don't want to overrun it for you.
Well, we're about three. Can we go about 10 more minutes or so? Is that good?
Okay. Then I got some going out questions for you.
Sure.
So other than work, what have you done during this lockdown time? Netflix, Amazon, podcasting?
Oh, boy. You know, so like we said, since unfortunately so many people have been hurt during the pandemic, and it's not a time that any of us have enjoyed or was able to see coming. But I do think there were certain things that were learned. And I think there were there were things that we learned about ourselves. So for me, I mean, like anybody, and it seems like so long ago, but I was watching the shows on Netflix, that everybody else was watching. And we all started, I already had a subscription, but started watching more shows on Netflix and other channels in general. Fitness has always been important to me, but that's something that I probably stepped up more. So I spent a lot more time focusing on fitness, maybe not going to a gym, maybe having a gym in the house now. But that was also something that I think helped me evolve, I guess, during COVID, and reading a lot more. And those are the things, obviously, that are not work related, but even spending time with the family and making sure that we were doing more things together. And we've always been that way. But when you're home with your kids and with your wife, you realize just how important those things are. So I think we've all learned a lot of lessons during COVID. But yeah, I have also worked really hard in the business. Our business has grown a lot over the last year.
I was going to say, definitely with the lockdowns and people watching that painful moment of the market last year, they're just like, we actually need an expert in this kind of thing.
Well, that's exactly right. So the number of second opinions that we have offered and performed over the last 12 months is probably greater than any other period in time. And we literally have had clients introduce us to family members of theirs. Connections that we have just in the area in general and different professions have referred people to us. So yeah, from a business point of view, again, the business has grown pretty substantially over this period of time. But yeah, but I think just in general, I think we've all grown in general from this. And I spend my time doing different things. I watch a lot more YouTube videos, kind of enjoy following certain people and doing things like that. But reading has definitely become a big part of what I spend my time during the day doing, as well as fitness, trying to eat well, even meditation, which was something that quite honestly I had never done before. And during the pandemic, I started getting into meditation a little bit and making it part of my daily routine as well.
Meditation is one of those, it's perceived as the woo-woo like fancy stuff, but it's actually really practical.
It is, you know, and I would probably say I looked at it that way for a while before I got into it, as you described. But, you know, for me, it's just a way of spending a few minutes each day at a certain period of the day, just kind of having some calmness and not thinking about anything. And you realize how difficult it is to do that because you want to check your phone. You start thinking about certain things that you have to do. So it's nice to have a little bit of that quiet time. So that's certainly something that I've introduced and I've actually really enjoyed quite a bit. Again, it goes back to training like an athlete, right? Trying to keep getting better and better at what you do. And if you need to add certain things like that to help, why not?
Exactly. It's not really going to cost you other than 5 minutes of your time.
That's exactly right. Otherwise it's free. You're right.
Right. So the other question I like asking is for someone aspiring to be like you, a financial advisor, what is some advice you would give them to shorten their path to achieve your position?
Yeah. For anyone looking to get into wealth management business, the business has changed substantially from when I began. When I started in the business in the 90s, you were a solo practitioner. You had a very low success rate. I think at the time it was under 10% of anyone who got in the business would still be in the business 12 months later. Now it's changed. So a couple of things that I've learned and advice I give to anybody looking to get in the business, first of all, is to join a team. Okay. Don't go at it alone. It is extremely difficult to get into this business and compete against the larger teams in the business who just quite honestly have a lot more experience. So join a team. And if you're going to join a team, take whatever role they're willing to give you so that you can get introduced to the business and find out what you like about it and don't like about it. Once you get on the team, then hopefully you will have opportunity to grow with the team as you learn. But part of that learning also is really my second recommendation, which we hear a lot about, which is finding someone. I know the term mentor comes up quite a bit, but finding a mentor, someone who can help you learn and get into the business. For me, I didn't have a mentor early on in the business. I actually ended up getting one later in the business, which has been a phenomenal thing for me. But 100%, I would say anybody looking to get into wealth management business, it is a great business. You take a lot of satisfaction of being able to help people achieve their goals. And again, not make bad mistakes when it comes to their money, but don't go at it alone. The success rate is extremely low. Join a successful team and be persistent as well. Whenever you're looking for a job these days, again, it's become very different. You know, you can reach out to people in so many different ways. Be persistent. If you want a job or you want to get into a certain industry, go after it.
Yes. No, that's the biggest one. Like you were saying, especially nowadays with the lockdowns, even though it messed up the educational system, I wanted to get in a different industry. I'm like, okay. I'm like, banks, I'll get into banks kind of thing. It's a step into financial as I could, but it's also better pay. They were like, you have to have a BS in finance. I'm like, to be a clerk? Why? Kind of thing. But it was just interesting. One of the people I was talking to on the show was like, you know, you could have gone for a different position as long as you knew that person. And then you'd like education is one of those, it's an easy filter. Like, they don't actually need it. If you have relevant experience and the person can confirm it, they'll easily just put you at the top of the list.
That's interesting. Well, that listen, it comes down to a lot of times your connections and who you know.
But also,
I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, it's also the, like what you were saying earlier, being consistent and persistent.
It is. I mean, look at what LinkedIn has offered many of us, right? I mean, what a great way from a business point of view to connect with people that normally you would have no way of connecting with.
Right.
And what a powerful, powerful tool that didn't exist, you know, 20 some odd years ago or so. So right. Yes, you're exactly right about that. And you know what? Listen, you don't take no for an answer to some degree. I mean, not with the bank per se, but just with wanting to get into the industry. If that's what you want to do, find a way to do it. Maybe that wasn't the right place. Maybe there's another place. Again, everything happens for a reason, but if you want it bad enough, you just have to get it. Nobody, and I've always lived by this, nobody is standing on the corner waiting to give you something, right? You want something, you literally have to go out and just get it yourself.
That's brilliant. I'd love to cut it there. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you. I had a great time. I appreciate you having me. This was a lot of fun.
It was an absolute blast and a pleasure.
Well, congratulations. You made it to the end. You're an awesome person. Not many make it here. So, being the awesome person that you are, can you do me one more awesome favor? Can you rate and review this on whatever podcast services you're using? App, if you do it on Apple and you leave an actual written review, I have a thing on my website. I will take your written review and post it for all to see. Congratulations, you're permanently sealed on my site. Otherwise, I am trying to do YouTube more and live streaming. I will try to put as many of the YouTube links in the description of the show as I can. So give your boy some extra help over on YouTube. Watch my videos. I just mute it and change the channel, change the window or something. But yeah, that's it. Thank you for being awesome and see you next time.